Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm here with our producer, Vishak, and my co-host, Sam. Hi, guys.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Now, tonight, we have our guest, Dr. Noe Romo, to discuss firearm safety. But first, before we get to that discussion, Sam, do you want to remind us about the show?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Noe Romo. Dr. Romo's academic focus is on the epidemiology of violence and the use of hospital-based and community violence intervention and prevention strategies. He's the director of the Pediatrics Inpatient Service at New York City Health and Hospital's Jacoby Department and is an associate professor in pediatrics at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine, as well as a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics with an additional subboard of pediatric hospital medicine. He is also the medical director of both the Stand Up to Violence program at Jacoby and the New York State Department of Clinical Justice, Criminal Justice, SNUG Hospital Violence Intervention Programs. He teaches us about important anticipatory guidance regarding firearm safety and healthcare maintenance visits and how to bring up the topic in a primary care setting, as well as the multidisciplinary care involved in the management of patients being treated with firearm-related injuries.
Hi, Dr. Romo. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
First, because we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Absolutely.
And is Noe?
Noe. Yep.
Excellent. No, excellent. All right, Noe, since you're sort of new to our audience, I was wondering whether you could describe a little bit about yourself, who you are, maybe something outside of medicine that you like.
Yeah, so I'm a pediatric hospitalist over at New York City Health and Hospitals Jacoby, which is a public hospital in the Bronx, New York. I am also an associate professor in pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and also currently act as medical director for our hospital's violence intervention program, which we started around 10 years ago. And I'm currently also functioning as a medical director for New York State's Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Prevention Network that's funded by the Department of Criminal Justice. I have been working at Jacoby now for about 10 years or so, and I've been engaging in this community and hospital-based work since then and have been published in the medical literature regarding the programming that we've had in place since then, and actively involved in teaching both medical students and residents as well. In terms of one thing outside of medicine, I am a runner, and I've been a runner since I was in high school. I ran D1 cross country and track in college as well, and I currently still do marathons, not as competitively as I used to from back when I was younger, but I still try to actively engage in that activity. I actually just ran the Chicago Marathon 2 weeks ago. So.
Oh, fantastic. I was wondering, I was about to ask you which marathons you've run recently, because I knew Chicago was just passed, so
yep.
Fantastic, fantastic. Anyone else have questions?
Yeah. So, Dr. Romo, I was just wondering, what was the best advice you ever received as a learner or as a teacher or any time in your career?
You know, I would say when I was chief resident, my chairman came into called me into his office, and you know, we were just talking, and he told me a piece of advice I never forgot, which was never forget what got you into the game. And what he meant by that was, like, no matter where your career takes you, never give up your clinical practice or your clinical duties. Even if you, you know, get on research or whatever you're doing or you're teaching, never give up your clinical practice, because that's what got you into the game. And if for some reason things fall through the cracks and you're not able to, you know, do anything else, you can always go back to just being a clinician. And that always kind of keeps you humble, and it keeps you kind of set in kind of why you do what you do. So I think that's one of the best pieces of advice I've ever received.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, as a sort of a, I guess they're calling me a mid-career physician these days. I know. And, you know, as you take on more roles and they get FTE to do other leadership or other admin stuff, you start thinking, it's like, do I really want to give up more of my clinical? But I love what I do. And so I appreciate that advice so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. I'll ask kind of the last intro question, then we'll get into the case that Vishak has. But, you know, we also ask sometimes best advice, but also favorite failure. You know, we're curious on this show. Is there anything that that sticks out to mind and anything that our listeners can learn from it as well?
You know, it's interesting when we talk about favorite failure, because it's hard to call any kind of failure a favorite, right?
Yeah.
But I think they all kind of present its own set of kind of learning opportunities. Actually, I'm going to go with a recent one, actually a running analogy, because I just ran the Chicago Marathon. And now that I'm older, you know, I've grown to accept that my speed has taken a hit and I'm not as competitive as I used to be. I used to be very, very competitive and ran fairly well. And, you know, I still train pretty well and I train hard, and I was running really well for the first half marathon. And around the 13th mile, I pulled my left hamstring, and I've never stopped ever in a race. And I had to stop and stretch and, you know, massage it out, and had to really ponder, like, am I going to be able to continue? Should I just stop? And you know, I started back a little by little, and I was like, all right, you know what? I pretty much let go of the time I wanted. I knew I was going to get it, and I let go. I wasn't competitive, which is really hard to just let people kind of pass me consciously and consciously slow my pace down. But I said my goal is to finish, and I knew my family was waiting for me at the 23rd mile. I have a 6-year-old daughter, a 3-year-old son, and my wife. So that was like, I got to get there. They got to see me run by, right? And I got there. I ran by them, and I finished not in the best time, the slowest time I ever ran, actually. But I remember when I finished, you know, and I was a little bit hurt. And my 6-year-old daughter asked me, well, Papa, why didn't you stop if you were hurt? And I said, you know, I thought about it, but because I had trained so hard and I wanted to run a certain time. But sometimes you got to change course, and that's okay. Sometimes you got to adjust in a race, and you got to slow down, and you still finish. It may not be the time you wanted. It may not be the way you thought it was going to be, but nonetheless, you finished, and it's okay to change course sometimes. And I think that's just the finish line changes, you know, as you go on. You know, before it used to be you want to hit certain times, you want to hit record times, you want to be competitive. And then as you get older, you realize that was a huge win. You know, my daughter got to see me run, and I got to show her that lesson, and that's okay.
I mean, that's the perfect analogy of life, right? Like, we all have like this thought of what our goal is, but then as we're in the middle of the race, sometimes you realize that there are other goals that might be actually more important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you throw your other piece of advice in there, which is don't forget what got you in the game, and you put those two together, and that actually is the advice for life. So just for everyone to think about as we move forward and start to talk about this case, but as we always talk about our careers, as you know, as you go from the beginning to the end.
Yep.
So thank you.
If you're ever interested in doing a running podcast, I'm happy to oblige and take part of that.
There we go. Got part two. EZ Resus is your ultimate support to take care of your sickest patients during resuscitation. Whether you are taking care of a newborn during a precipitous delivery, a septic child requiring endotracheal intubation, or a seizing teenager, this offline app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms all available in under 3 clicks. This gives you rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface, taking care of the logistics of resuscitation so you can take care of what really matters, your patient. For those who do not work with critically ill patients, the app also has calculated doses of the most used PO and IV medications, including antibiotics and analgesia. Also, you can find critical first steps for basic and advanced life support, which could be useful for anyone, anywhere. Finally, for those in our audience who also work with adult patients, there is a complete adult section with the same features as in pediatrics, including weight-adjusted dosing for heavier patients, treatment algorithms, and more. So someday you'll need to act outside of your comfort zone, and with EZ Resus, you will be ready. So CryptSiders listeners, here are the benefits. They're made for all clinicians and all patients with a user-friendly interface, 100% offline content and available on any device, drug dosing, treatment algorithms, and equipment size dynamically calculated based on patient characteristics, multiple alerts and content adjusted to age and weight to ensure safety, content entered and reviewed by over 30 healthcare professionals, and available for institutional access, including an online version, group pricing, customizable content, and exclusive features. So, listeners of the CribSiders get access to a 2-month free trial, letting them use 100% of the features of the app. So download EZ Resus on the App Store or Google Play Store, create your account, use code CribSiders, that's code CribSiders, and then start using EZ Resus. And for more information, visit www.ezresus.com/CribSiders. That's www.ezresus.com/CribSiders. And lastly, for learners, that's students and residents, the app is completely free for the first 2 years.
I think we should get to our first case then, huh?
Yep.
Ashok, what do you got, man?
All right, let's start. So you're seeing a 10-year-old patient, Allie, in for a well child check. At the end of the visit, her parents mentioned that they saw on the news the firearm-related deaths in children have been significantly increasing. They bring up that they have a registered firearm in the house. So just to start off, can you give us a brief overview with regards to the scope of firearm injuries in the pediatric population specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, as of 2021, firearm-related injury is now the leading cause of mortality for children in the United States. It kind of overtook motor vehicle crashes as a leading cause of death, and there's been a significant rise specifically, I think, from since 2018, there's been about a 41% increase in the firearm death rate, specifically between 2018 and 2021 for pediatric mortality. And the majority of this mortality, about 82%, is occurring in the age group of 15 to 19-year-olds, so in our young adolescent population. There was definitely a increase post-COVID, in particular in the summer of 2020. With a significant increase in both pediatric and adult firearm-related injury and firearm-related mortality. I think the reasons for that are multiple. And at the time, it was hard to discern what was going on nationally and locally. Here in the Bronx specifically, we had an 85% increase, actually, in firearm-related injury that we got from June to September of 2020. And it was right after the peak of the COVID pandemic here. And when we were trying to look at, you know, reasons as to why that was occurring, you know, I think we kind of realized when looking at what was going on, there were two major things, I think, that happened that contributed to that increase. I think, first and foremost, you know, you can't ignore the effects of the COVID pandemic in neighborhoods like the Bronx, right? Obviously, a lot of the same complex socioeconomic factors that contributed to COVID mortality also contributed to firearm-related mortality, right? So, places like the Bronx, you know, where a large portion of the population, one, is living below a federal poverty line already and is working primarily in the service sector, lost a lot of their jobs. And I think also schools closed down, summer schools closed down, summer programs closed down, community centers were shut down. There was literally nothing for children to do. There were all supportive services and mechanisms were completely collapsed, right? And on top of that, you had areas like the Bronx that were disproportionately affected by COVID mortality and morbidity. So you had the added stress of that, along with the social isolation, which obviously increased the incidence of a lot of mental health issues and stressors. And then you had about an 85% national increase in the sales of legal firearms. So whenever you have an increase of sales of legal firearms, you unfortunately also have an associated increase in the illegal gun trafficking. Specifically for places like New York City, there's a significant increase in the illegal trafficking of guns up the I-95 corridor from the southeastern part of the United States up to the northeast. So you kind of combine all of those factors, right? And it was kind of the perfect storm for there to be an increase in firearm-related mortality in both pediatrics and adult populations.
What are some other known risk factors or metrics that we should know about? I guess one question I have, I assume that just knowing that there's a presence of a firearm in the home increases your risk for a firearm-related injury. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, you know, it's been well documented that having a gun in the home increases the risk of completed homicide threefold and of completed suicide twofold, right? That's been well documented in the literature over and over again as a known risk factor for firearm-related injury in the pediatrics population. And what's also known is that there are ways to mitigate. And I think the primary way to mitigate that is to kind of promote things like safe storage for guns in the home, right? Is screening for guns in the home, but also providing education on safe storage, because it is well documented that if you keep a firearm locked in a lock compartment, separate from ammunition that's kept in a separate lock compartment, that is almost just as safe as not having a firearm in the home at all. And there's a simple mnemonic that's often used when screening for pediatric firearms in the home called the 5 L's, which is you ask, if there is a gun in the home, you ask if it's loaded. You ask if the owner has learned, meaning do they know that if they keep the firearms separate from ammunition stored in separate compartments, it's just as safe. Is there any little children around? Is anyone in the house feeling low, aka depression? Because it's also known that if there's any significant mental health issues in the home, that also heightens your risk of a completed firearm-related suicide and homicide.
So I was actually hoping that we could, just jumping back to the case for a second, because you gave us an awesome overview that, you know, the world that changed drastically with COVID, along with the increased sale of firearms, all kind of put this amalgamation together, that increased firearm-related injuries and death.
Yeah.
Rather than what I was hoping you were going to say is, oh, of course, you know, we just did such a good job with our car seats, and so therefore that went down instead. But unfortunately, no, that's not the case. Going back to our case, let's talk about kind of the questions you want to ask this family when they reveal this to you, kind of where you want to go from there, how you have this conversation, and kind of take us through, because I will have some follow-up questions about that.
Yeah, no, I think... So I think the screening for firearm issue is important, right? And in pediatrics, we like to talk a lot about screening for injury prevention and then counseling. And I think the issue we have to really think about closely with firearm-related injury and screening is that it's really going to be very dependent on the population, right? For example, screening for firearms, say, like the Midwest or the South area, or even here at Upstate New York in a rural area, is very different and screening for firearms here in the Bronx, right? Because in certain areas, it's very common for many people to own firearms in the home. It's part of the culture, whether it's used for hunting or other purposes. And in those areas, people will be quite open if you ask about firearms in the home, and will tell you they have a firearm in the home. And it's a lot easier to implement a lot of interventions around safe storage and things like that in terms of asking if you do have a gun, where are you keeping it? Are you keeping it locked? Are you keeping it like loaded? If you are, then counseling on keeping it locked and unloaded and separate from ammunition, right? Screening for people in the home who may be depressed or having mental health issues or active thoughts of homicide and suicide, try to mitigate those factors. And if there's, you know, children around who could easily access that gun, right? And is that gun accessible? Those types of interventions in settings where people are open to admitting that there are guns in the home work. I think a lot of the issues we have is when a lot of those type of studies or interventions try to be applied to populations like inner city, where the majority of guns are illegally owned and not legally owned. So most parents and young adults will not be so forthcoming about admitting that there is a gun in the home, in which case the firearm storage intervention may not be as effective unless you're doing a blanket across the board to every single person, right? Kind of similar, I guess, to what we do with car seats. Like, you just kind of, at the primary care level, you just counsel everybody on car seat safety, right? Regardless, you just presume everybody has a car seat. So I think that's kind of the challenge when it comes to firearm storage education, because it's very different based on the population you're dealing with.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up as well, because so I did residency in Providence, Rhode Island, which is not, would argue, a place that was, you know, completely open with the amount of guns that we had, you know. And we do a very good job, just like most probably academic centers and especially resident clinics, of, hey, we have a template in our note. And so we have to ask each of those questions. But I did have that sense of, how am I going to ask this question to this group of patients? And how is it also going to affect my doctor-patient relationship? And whether it does or doesn't, I don't know. And that's why I was wondering if you can comment on how we can ask those questions in a way that's, you know, that we could really keep that going wise.
So I think the best way is to really just kind of normalize the conversation around injury prevention in general, and perhaps just kind of preface it as like, you know what, I need to ask these questions universally to everybody just regarding injury prevention in children. So I'm going to ask you things like, you know, things about car seats, things about road safety, summer safety, you know, things like that. And part of that may include asking about guns in the home and just making it, I think, part of the general accepted norm of injury prevention in children. Just like I'm going to ask you about, you know, wearing a helmet if you're riding a bike, I'm going to ask you if there's a gun in the home. And if you say no, good, we're moving on, you know? And I think that's just kind of probably the best way to do it. And I think also not being so insistent, perhaps, if people really do pull back, especially in inner city populations, because they don't necessarily want to disclose it, because there's obviously a general fear of retribution if they do commit to that. But in places where people are open to it, or perhaps it is more socially acceptable and there are guns that are legally owned, things like distribution of gun locks can help, for example, in the pediatric setting to try to kind of mitigate kind of accidental shootings as well. And in fact, even in places like New York, you know, in my, you know, new work that I'm going throughout the state and visiting all these other sites and programs, things look very different. For example, say in Buffalo or even in Albany, which is more in the middle of the state than they do in New York City, where there's a lot more legal gun ownership. And these types of interventions can be part of a hospital-based violence intervention program more kind of routinely because the population is more open to it.
Yeah, so you were sort of seeing that about a hospital-based intervention, and then obviously you're a hospitalist. This is sort of your area. Yeah. You know, we were sort of clarifying before that, you know, this patient and this child and their family is here for a well child check in this case.
Yeah.
So it seems to make more sense. Okay, well, I'm in preventative mode, so I have a whole bunch of questions for screening. How do we decide on an inpatient basis who are we going to screen and at what point this is going to happen? Are you doing this? You're admitting them for their URI or some or bronchiolitis, and then you're just doing your H&P, and you're just like, I'm just doing my general screening. Like, is that where it happens, or does it happen on discharge, or do you save this for certain people versus others? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, you know, in terms of screening for firearms, again, it's similar to what I was mentioning about it being patient dependent. We actually did try to institute intervention here at some of the hospitals in the Bronx, and we were part of it, to seeing if it would be worthwhile to do something like that on the inpatient setting. And we got very, very few positives and very, very few patients that were open to that type of screening and even intervention on admission. So we kind of pulled back and said, you know, I don't think it was worthwhile doing this level of screening on admission because very, very few people actually reported it. And the people that did, it was mostly patients whose parents were like in law enforcement or things like that for the most part. So I think in that case, I think our hospital-based violence intervention approach kind of changed to be geared more towards the population we were working with and making more of a community-based approach and making more based on a conflict mediation-based approach using community outreach workers to try to kind of, because it was a very, very different epidemiologic state that we were dealing with here, with community violence versus, say, accidental firearm-related violence that is typically seen perhaps in other more rural populations.
I actually like that as an answer. You know, we're hoping that, oh, you know, you just ask, and this is how you ask. But, you know, it turns out people are not that open with it. And you guys clearly recognize that and took a step back and say, hey, how else can we use our time and resources with which to make a difference? Not necessarily that you don't, you know, aren't going to do something. It's just going to go at a different angle. And so I appreciate that. And it makes me feel a little bit better, though, about my, you know, my skills in asking, at least as when I was in primary care clinic.
Yeah.
So to kind of segue a little bit back, I was wondering if we could just flush out the rest of kind of the risk factors and the disparities that might exist with the pediatric firearm injuries.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's definitely, like most things in pediatrics and in general in the population, right? Poverty, and poverty is associated with an increased risk of firearm-related injury in pediatrics. And also, it disproportionately affects certain racial populations. And particularly, there are definitely some racial and ethnic differences among children who are victimized by firearms. So about 67% of children who are victimized are Black for firearm-related homicide. Close to about 20% are Hispanic. And, you know, that really is completely different from what we see, let's say, in firearm-related suicide in children, where about 79% of children who commit suicide are white. So there's definitely a discrepancy there in terms of firearm-related injury, where the majority of children who die from homicide from firearms are Black, whereas the majority of children who die from suicide from firearms are white. And this trajectory kind of continues on into adulthood. And I like to think of New York City as being a little bit of a microcosm of what we're seeing nationally. So in New York City, about 53% of the entire population is either Black or Hispanic, and yet Black and Hispanics account for 96% of all gunshot wound victims, right? So when we talk about racial and ethnic discrepancies, I mean, that's it right there, right? And those numbers speak for themselves, and it definitely is the unfortunate same pattern that we are seeing in our trauma center here in the Bronx, where about 98% of the children that we see who are victimized by violent trauma are Black or Hispanic.
So then what specific anticipatory guidance then would you focus, would you give to this family specifically with Allie and her family with regards to proper and safe firearm storage and safety?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if they're open to the intervention, and again, if I'm in a population where I know that the there is a high percentage of people who have legal firearms and are quite open about revealing that, then, you know, I think I would counsel, like I mentioned, using the simple acronym called the 5 L's, right? I mean, just trying to find out, is the gun locked? Is it loaded? Is the owner learned? Meaning, do they know that they need to keep the gun in a separate lock compartment from ammunition that's kept separately in the lock compartment? Is there little children around that have access to that gun? And is there anyone feeling low, aka having depression or mental health issues that would predispose them to suicide or homicide?
Now, with that's a multi-pronged approach at looking at different ways to hopefully create a better place of safety with the firearm in the home. Do we have studies looking at each component to see how effective they are at reducing firearm-related injuries or death?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the literature is pretty clear that if you do counsel people on firearm storage, they are more likely to engage in that behavior. Obviously, it's not 100%. No intervention is 100%, you know, but there are at least a more recent study, especially when looking at what they call nudging versus nudge parents, meaning when you use kind of an EMR approach, but also incorporate a standardized approach using providers and nurses and clerics to help further amplify the encouragement of that advice, it does have more of an effect of people adhering to the advice, you know. And I think it's important to note, you know, that the majority of people and legal gun owners in this country, you know, don't want their children to be victimized, you know, by the gun in the home. They do want to store it safely. They do want to do it responsibly. I don't think anyone wants any kind of accidental or non-accidental injuries in the home. So I think by and large, if you know your population and you're aware of the circumstances of the population, you can engage that patient population in an active way to try to intervene using firearm storage proven mechanisms.
And then, you know, one of the L's you mentioned was little, as in little kids, you know, this sounds like a very good approach for toddlers or young, even you'd say early school age kids. Is there any shift that we should be thinking of when it comes to these discussions, when it comes for older kids or adolescents who can clearly find out where each lockbox is or at least open them?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that makes it even more imperative to make sure that it is, that the gun is stored, locked and unloaded, right? And that there's no one else knows the code to that lock or even where it is, especially when you reach adolescence, where we know, you know, that the adolescent mind is by definition and pathophysiologically not developed, right? And they're more prone to impulsivity, right? So, you know, more often than not, at least when we talk about firearm-related suicide in teenagers, right, there's often some underlying depression or anxiety, and then there's some issue that happens acutely that stresses the system. And you know, if you know there's a firearm in a home and you are having even a fleeting thought of committing suicide and the firearm is right there and accessible, your impulsivity may take over and you may not have the ability to stop yourself from doing that, right? And that's not necessarily the young man or woman's fault. They're supposed to be impulsive in that age. And if they have easy access to something that they can hurt themselves with, they will use it. So I think it is even more imperative to ensure that as the little children grow, the firearms are kept locked and unloaded, along with ammunition being kept in separate compartments.
I think you mentioned a couple of the barriers, but what other barriers would you say are as well present in the primary care settings to prevent safe and proper anticipatory guidance for firearm safety?
Well, you know, I think I did touch upon the differences based on kind of population in terms of rural versus urban. I think is really the biggest challenge in implementing this type of intervention, because the mechanisms are very different, the circumstances are very different, and I think there is a clear difference between legal and illegal gun ownership and whether those guns are being used in the home or for hunting purposes, or they're being used to perpetuate, let's say, community violence in urban settings. I think those two areas require very different kind of approaches. So I think those two things kind of are really probably the biggest barriers to this type of intervention.
I think one thing that I wanted to look at with this question in particular is, I remember very clearly as I was just as I was graduating residency, I think maybe it was like 2010, 2011, there was like a whole gag rule out of Florida that prevented pediatricians or any physician from asking about guns in the home. I think that law has since been repealed, but I mean, are we seeing things like this, like nationwide? Are these like, is this a typical thing that we should be seeing? Do we need to be researching these in our states before we ask patients and their families?
No. Yeah. I mean, I do think it's important to be aware of local laws, the state laws. Thankfully, you're right. That law, Florida gag law, was kind of revoked as it being unconstitutional. And that is not something that you could, like, you can't not allow physicians to ask certain questions when it comes to patient safety and health. And that was pretty well demarcated with that. So thankfully, that has not been the case for other states. I think that ruling kind of nixed that. But that doesn't mean that there's not barriers that are placed sometimes and that there is some stigma that may be placed. Obviously, this is a very politically charged issue when it comes to kind of gun control and safe storage. And oftentimes, even talking about safe storage, you can be deemed as being quote-unquote anti-gun, right? Because the politics are so heavy. So I think it's our job as physicians to really try to stay away from the politics, at least when you're dealing with the patient individually, and just make it clear that you're just, again, if you're making it a general about injury prevention, when you're talking about car safety or summer safety or winter safety or bike safety, gun safety, it's all just part of the general continuum of safety and injury prevention. I think that can help kind of depoliticize and destigmatize the conversation.
I really like that approach, you know, trying not to use, not to be standoffish, not to look, you know, as you're talking to patients and their families, and any, you know, you're just talking because you want them to be safe, and that you're not making a personal attack at their views on guns at all, but you just want to discuss how to, if you have a gun, how to be safe with it. So,
yeah.
Awesome. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about primary prevention. We should probably talk about secondary prevention kind of our next topic. Vishak, would you mind reading the next part of our case?
Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit. So you're now taking care of 15-year-old Joshua, who was admitted to the pediatric inpatient unit for management of a gunshot wound to the leg. He's currently medically stable, and the medical team is planning for a safe discharge for Joshua. So just from an overall kind of standpoint, what's the multidisciplinary approach that should be involved to ensure Joshua's safe discharge?
Yeah, so, you know, Vishak, being a resident at a city hospital in the Bronx, I know this is something that you have seen commonly, unfortunately, and unfortunately pretty routinely for him. It's not that uncommon, you know, as for some of the people in pediatric inpatient unit, and maybe, oh, we got an asthma admission, we got an appendicitis, we got a cellulitis, and we got a GSW. It's not that uncommon to have that on our inpatient wards. I think first and foremost, I think it's important to recognize the kind of atypical nature, right, of having this degree of violent trauma at this age, and what that can do to the individual, right? And understanding that we tend to stigmatize patients, and we have a lot of unconscious bias, right? First we hear 15-year-old GSW, our mind may automatically go, oh, this kid's probably involved in a gang. He's probably involved in some kind of illegal activity, right? That's automatically where our unconscious bias goes. And I think what we have to really understand is that, you know, this is a child who suffered a significant trauma. And I think it's our job as hospitalists and pediatricians to not just treat acute illness, but also prevent that same illness from occurring, right? Because if we're discharging patients back to the same situations or circumstances that led to their initial injury, then what are we really doing, right? If they're going to just come right back with the same injury, we need to figure out a way to prevent them from coming back. And that was kind of the impetus behind how we started our hospital violence intervention program at Jacoby. I was a resident there. I was chief resident there, and seeing the same cycle of violent trauma coming over and over again, right? Started seeing some patients one, twice in a year. Maybe they came in for an assault or a stab wound, and they came in back for a gunshot wound. Maybe they came back for a more serious gunshot wound, if not dead. And just trying to figure out, well, what can we do as a hospital to intervene in these patients? And I think what we found was that a multidisciplinary approach incorporating three major pillars of social work, physician, and community outreach components were critical. And I think what that means is that you really treat the patient as a whole. And obviously, we tend to the medical needs, but we also have dedicated social workers who are dedicated to address their specific needs in terms of their perhaps their mental health needs in terms of the acute stress disorder and PTSD symptoms that are very common in this population, along with addressing perhaps some of the other complex socioeconomic factors, whether it be housing instability, food insecurity, perhaps, you know, physical sexual abuse actively or in the past that has been going on. And then the community outreach component is incorporating community outreach workers who can work in a hospital setting, who can identify with these young men and women who are perhaps from these neighborhoods, and they can provide a sense of comfort and also provide a sense of kind of ease to better understand the circumstances that perhaps led to this individual's injury. We talked a little bit about people not being so forthcoming, for example, let's say about revealing the gun ownership in this population, right? Well, people are also not as forthcoming about regarding the circumstances about why they were injured, right? And I think Vishak could probably agree with me on this, that if we just go up by our own and ask this person, hey, so what happened? They're like, I don't know. You know, I just kind of got shot. I don't know. I was walking down the street. And it's very different when we're asking the question as opposed to, let's say, an individual from their community who they perhaps even know, who looks like them, talks like them, dresses like them, who is someone who they can trust, who can ask, hey, so tell me a little bit about what happened. Perhaps they may say, hey, you know what? I've had this issue with this group of individuals from this other rival neighborhood, and this is what happened. So it allows you to perhaps engage a patient in conflict mediation, connect them to supportive services, long-term mentorship services to try to prevent this individual from coming back.
Can you talk a little more about these community outreach workers? Are they specially trained to do what they are? Are they volunteers? Yep. Are they hired? Like who are they?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like they're obviously from their community and they have some sort of experience with this, but I sort of want to know a little more about who these people are.
So these community outreach workers function as what we call hospital responders, and essentially what we call like violence interrupters, right? And they have specific training that they have to fulfill through New York State, through the New York State Department of Criminal Justice, through their SNCC programming of conflict mediation strategies and case management to develop the skills to engage patients and connect them to supportive services. They are hired by the hospital through grant funding that they provide, the state provides to the hospital to hire them. They are hired by the same entities that hire us physicians, right? They have the same benefit structure as we do. And for many of them, this may be their first job. All of these community outreach workers and hospital responders have lived in these neighborhoods. Some perhaps even have had unfortunate prior victimizations with violent trauma. Some of them may have even perhaps been involved before in some of the complex issues in the inner city that lead to violent trauma victimization, but they are no longer, and they have grown, and they are now acting as kind of in a positive role in their neighborhoods and trying to implicate change in individuals. So these individuals can connect with patients in ways that we never could because they're able to engage with them and connect with them in ways that we couldn't.
Another question about sort of the multidisciplinary team as a whole. Mm-hmm. So is this a, so with the social worker, obviously there's so many different things that can, you know, so many different social determinants and, you know, people are complex, lives are complex.
Yes.
Do you train all your teams who will be interfacing with, you know, a patient who may be a victim of gun violence, or is it, do you have, I have a patient with, you know, a firearm injury. We have a special team that only handles these. So because of how maybe specialized that might be.
No. So what's unique about our programming, which started 10 years ago, was we kind of redefined violent trauma to not just limit it to firearm related injuries. So we also include stab wounds and assaults, because I think we understand that there's a spectrum to violent trauma. And that if you are victimized as an assault or a stab wound, then you're more likely to come back then with a gunshot wound and vice versa, right? It is a spectrum. So I think it's important to try to engage individuals along that spectrum to prevent them from moving along that spectrum, right? As in terms of morbidity and mortality. So every member of our team is receives specific training for their specific roles, whether you're a social worker or a community outreach worker or a hospital responder or a supervisor. Obviously, there is specific training that's involved for each of the roles that New York State provides to the Department of Criminal Justice Services. But there is an organization to it. There is a supervisory to it. There is oversight to it to engage a lot of these individuals and give them the tools that they need to be able to help these patients and community participants as well.
You know, speaking of criminal justice, that's another area I have a question about, because obviously if someone is coming in with some sort of injury, it's possible that, you know, even though they, it's, there's a high possibility that they had nothing to do with the situation, where wrong place, wrong time, but they actually could have been part of it. And so how, you know, how does that complicate the whole picture in terms of management, prevention, and anticipate? Because, you know, they may end up going into some sort of correctional system afterwards, or, you know, how does that work?
Well, you know, I think it's not uncommon for us to have some patients who are actively under arrest, who have perhaps had active warrants and now they're injured and they're in the hospital and they are actively under arrest. So we do have to deal with the authorities and with the police in general. So our community outreach component consists of a network of community outreach workers and supervisors and dedicated social workers that engage community participants who have not yet been victimized, but who are at risk of being victimized. And it connects them to supportive services and provides longitudinal mentorship to try to prevent these young men and women from ever even coming in. And I think because of that, we have had significant success. We've decreased the incidence of gunshot wounds in our designated target areas by 59% over the last 10 years compared to the surrounding neighborhoods that we are not present in. And I think that has helped at least our position with the NYPD, right, where they see the work that our outreach workers are doing. They see the effect it's having. They see the active change in individuals that they perhaps before were suspicious of or were targeting, thinking they were involved, who are now no longer. So what we like to say is that programs like ours work in parallel with the police, but not necessarily interject, because we cannot work directly with the authorities, because then we wouldn't have the credibility in the neighborhoods, right? The individuals wouldn't want to work with us if they knew we were directly linked with the police. But we do work in parallel, right? We like to say that we are preventative and the police is reactive. And not to knock what they do, they're important, they're needed when incidents happen, but they react once that incident's happened. Our job from the community outreach component is to prevent that incident from ever even happening, right? It's getting ahead of these mediations, having our outreach workers identify active community disputes, whether they be between rival neighborhoods or between individuals, to try to mitigate the circumstances of that dispute to prevent kind of the recurrent cycle of violent trauma from occurring back and forth.
And that's some awesome data that you're talking about. 59% decrease is huge.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we'd take anything over 10%, honestly. And I was wondering if that was mostly from the community outreach perspective, or you really talked about this three-pillar program and what, you know, what kind of data comes out of the all three pillars together?
Yeah, so that's the community piece that we are actively engaging to kind of, you know, do better data analysis of that piece, because really what we're doing right now is kind of just relying on historical data, concurrent data, and kind of comparing, you know, different ratios of what we're seeing in our community compared to other communities, or perhaps doing t-tests to compare those two. And we are working, I'm going to start working with the Columbia Middleman School of Public Health to try to better mitigate how we analyze that and kind of use a different approach to better kind of quantify the effect we're having at the community level. At the hospital level, we have published some of our data, especially in the Journal of Hospital Pediatrics. We were the first program to publish a hospital-based violence intervention approach and the effect that it has on young adolescent outcomes. And what we were able to show is that patients that we intervened in had an odds ratio of 0.41 in terms of re-injury 3 to 6 months after we saw them, and had a follow-up rate of 2.2 to their scheduled follow-up appointments compared to patients that we did not see. So we were able to improve the rates of follow-up in patients that we saw, along with decreasing the rates of re-injury. So it kind of showed how this multi-pronged approach can really have an impact directly on patient outcomes.
So, you know, Sam and I recently came back from AAP a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago or so. And the last time I was at AAP was also 2 years ago. And every time I go to AAP, I think one thing that is very commonly discussed in a lot of abstracts and posters and even many press releases from the AAP is about the importance of looking at violence, especially firearm violence.
Yeah.
The AAP, you know, states that a hospital-based violence prevention program definitely helps prevent re-injury for patients. My one question I have is, are there other versions of, so you obviously have intimate knowledge of how your program is structured and runs. Do you know much about how other programs are run? Are they run similarly? Are there different ways of doing this?
There are definitely many different ways of doing it. And I think it all depends on the population you're working with, you know, and I think it's important to really try to apply lessons learned from other settings into your setting, right? Just to use an example of what we're doing, yes, we've learned a lot over the last 10 years here in the City Hospital in the Bronx, and our approach has worked here. for this population. But now over the last 9 months that I've been working with the state to try to replicate some of these practices statewide in very different populations, whether they be up in Albany or Buffalo or Rochester, yeah, some of those have some of the similar kind of urban type of settings and socioeconomic factors, but others are also very rural and is very, very different. And some, there are a lot more perhaps psychiatric comorbidities. In some other centers, there's a lot more domestic-related violence. There's a lot more psychiatric-related violence, in which case those programs need more of a mental health approach, or they need a different kind of perspective if it is more of a domestic issue. So things are very different, and I think we have to be able to learn from our patients, from our populations, and apply lessons learned to those settings. And I think what we can say is that, look, at the very least, a multidisciplinary approach is what's needed. And every site will be different. But I do think that having an active social work physician and some type of community component, depending on the population, is imperative.
And it sounds like, I think that's a great lesson to take. Depending on the location, you might need to ramp up or ramp down one of those three pillars based on what you're seeing. So, Correct. Hey, this place has a lot more mental health issues, and so therefore, let's really make sure our social work and connection to, you know, to some of these outpatient therapists is going to be really where our money's at, versus another one might be, hey, this is all of community relations and we need to actually change housing demographics or anything along Right. those lines. And so you Right. kind of just do that based on your own, kind of almost like your own QI.
Right.
Sounds like what I'm hearing, which Yep. I'm excited to, now I feel very like, you know, ready to go and to do this, you know, in Philadelphia, which I'm sure we have a large component that's already there. So I will step that aside, but it's really nice to kind of take all those three things together and just kind of move those as you can.
Yeah.
So we touched in the previous case about the different racial as well as location-based disparities for firearm injuries. How do these hospital-based prevention, violence prevention programs that you've been talking about focus on the disparities that were mentioned?
Yeah, so, you know, I think the majority of these of the existing hospital-based violence intervention programs that currently exist nationally are primarily centered around urban centers, where a predominant portion of the population being victimized is either Black or Hispanic, and that is specifically to address these disparities. And the use of these community outreach workers and hospital responders are individuals that are from these same communities. And that's with the understanding that I think communities can heal themselves from within. And I think that's an important lesson to learn also for us working in the hospital, is that it's not enough for just the hospital or hospital systems or academic centers to come in and say, hey, this is how we're going to fix this problem in your community, right? It's incorporating community members, incorporating community input into the approach, so that communities can learn to heal themselves, right? So here we are employing people from the community with a certain lived experience with community violence and violent trauma, who are able to connect with patients in ways that we cannot as healthcare providers, and are able to provide a community-led approach almost to try to give people the tools that they need to kind of address this complex issue. And I think we have to just understand that, you know, people don't want to live in neighborhoods where they can't walk down the street with their children. People don't want to live in neighborhoods where they have to fear for their children walking to school or walking to the park, right? It's not a reality or an experience that people want. A lot of times it's necessity and the only place people can afford to live. And I think it's important to note that and to kind of understand that we have to learn from our patients and our population and meet them where they're at and try to address these complex issues, which I know are difficult to think about. And I think as hospitalists and as pediatricians, it's hard to think about things that are outside the realm of our control, right? We can only control certain things. We can't deal with a lot of these complex socioeconomic issues. But I think there are ways we can try to mitigate some of these factors.
And to kind of finish up about these hospital-based programs, you know, we actually didn't really spend that much time talking about the clinician. So I was hoping to at least ask that question off the bat. You know, what's the clinician's role in these programs? Anything that we should be, as doctors, knowing, or anything that we should be doing specifically?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, as medical director of the local program and medical director of the statewide program, you know, I think it's important to use our medical clout, for lack of a better word, and to really this public health approach and it kind of promoting this idea that this multidisciplinary approach is a public health approach, and that firearm-related trauma and morbidity mortality in pediatrics is a public health issue that we as a physician, as physicians, can take on and can treat in kind of ways that are creative. And thinking outside of the box, right, is getting outside of our own comfort zone as physician and as pediatric hospitalist, right? When I first started this, I was a fellow and I was getting my master's in, you know, in epidemiology along trying to do this kind of work. And I was, quite frankly, discouraged by some people. Like, why do you want to do violent trauma? Why do you want to deal with that? You're a hospitalist. You're a pediatric hospitalist. Why don't you worry about asthma? Why don't you worry about, you know, cellulitis? Like, let the criminal justice folks handle this. Let the social workers deal with this. And, you know, my response to them was always like, look, if children are getting shot, it is kind of my problem. They're getting admitted to my service, right? Like, I need to do something about it. To me, it is in the same realm as asthma, as appendicitis, as whatever else we're seeing. And I think it's important for us to think outside the box as physicians and be humble enough to recognize that we can't do it all and that we need to, you know, figure out mechanisms and promote ways to, you know, perhaps get funding for programs like this and help lead this effort in a multidisciplinary approach where we understand that it's going to take more than just us to heal these patients and communities.
Well, that was great, Dr. Romo. So as we wrap up kind of this wonderful discussion that we've been having, do you have any take-home points for our listeners, kind of like last messages that you want to say?
Yeah, you know, I was just recently at the Clinton Global Health Initiative event, and I was asked to go and speak on the issue of firearm-related injury and violence. And there was a lot of great speakers there. And right before I spoke, the current director of the World Health Organization said something that stood with me. And he said, peace is the best medicine. And it is 100% true, right? Regardless of what kind of work you're doing, if you just have peace, it would cure a lot of ills, right? It would take care of a lot of things and a lot of stressors and a lot of things that we deal with. And I think that we need to kind of work towards that, you know? And I think, you know, we didn't touch on kind of adverse childhood experiences and the fact that, you know, community violence is now its own distinct adverse childhood experience. But what I tell my outreach workers and hospital responders, like, look, if you guys prevent one single shot from being fired, you don't understand the effect that's having. That's one less child that's hearing that gunshot. That's one less person that is injured or taken away from this community, from this neighborhood, that's not contributing to the cycle of trauma. What we can't measure by an odds ratio or a p-value is the amount of violent trauma that we prevent by having this program. We just don't know. You know, by having these mechanisms in place, by engaging this 15-year-old young man perhaps who was shot, him not getting re-injured or him not shooting somebody else, we don't know the effect of that, right? We can't measure that. That's an immeasurable outcome. We can look at numbers and trends and try to kind of mimic what that effect is, but we have to understand there are some outcomes and factors that are immeasurable. And as long as we're preventing a single shooting, I think all these programs are worth it.
That was fantastic. I don't think we can end off the show any better way than that. I really appreciate the time you spent with us tonight. I certainly learned a lot about a program that I don't have access to and that I think would be really useful. And I think other people have probably never heard of these types of programs as well. So hopefully this will spur some efficacy in their areas and hopefully be able to do some good prevention in their communities.
Great. Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of the Cripsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get our show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Vishak Venkataraman, and our wonderful social media on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Vishak Venkataraman.
And this has been Chris the Chumanchu. Thank you and good night.